VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our topic on this edition of the program, Syria. Our guest, Charles Lister. He's Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute and author of the recent book, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. Formerly, Charles was a visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar. According to Lister, the eruption of the anti-Assad revolution in Syria has had many unintended consequences, among which is the opportunity it offered Sunni jihadists to establish a foothold in the heart of the Middle East. That Syria's ongoing civil war is so brutal and protracted has only compounded the situation, as have developments in Iraq and Lebanon. Raging across the battlefields and international borders have been dozens of jihadi Islamist fighting groups, of which some coalesced into significant factions, such as Jabhat al-Nusra, which has now changed its name to Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, or Front for the Conquest of Syria, and allegedly no longer owes its allegiance to al-Qaeda. And then there is the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL, ISIS, or Daesh. Lister's book, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency, assesses and explains the emergence since 2011 of Sunni jihadist organizations in Syria, charts their evolution, and situates them within the global Islamist project. He also discusses tensions between and conflict within such groups. We'll talk with Charles about how the battleground has become even more complicated due to Turkey's recent incursion across the border to fight both ISIS and U.S.-backed Syrian Kurds. How does the infighting between rebel groups, supported by both Turkey and the United States, against U.S.-supported Syrian Kurdish rebel units, affect the fight against ISIS? And can the U.S.-led fight against ISIS even succeed without addressing the Iranian and Russian-backed brutal Assad regime, whom many analysts say fuels Sunni extremism in the region? We'll also discuss Russia's entry almost 1 year ago to bolster the regime of Bashar al-Assad and the role of Iran. Some regional analysts are asserting that 3 years ago, when it was ascertained that Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons against his own people and President Obama drew a red line, but in the end did not proceed with limited military strikes, even as French jets were on the tarmac to assist, that the Obama administration demurred because it was negotiating a secret nuclear deal with Iran and it did not want to do anything that might undermine the negotiations with Iran, Syria's primary backer. Well, we'll discuss all this with Charles Lister, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And as always, delighted to welcome my colleague Jeff Selden.
My pleasure.
Well, Charles Lister, big question. 3 years on after the so-called red line event and 5 years into this terrible civil war, which has cost hundreds of thousands of lives, which has spawned a migrant crisis, refugee crisis, and continued conflict, what went wrong and when, do you think?
The list is probably too long to describe. I mean, there arguably was a potential opportunity in 2011 and 2012 for the international community to have placed a significant more amount of pressure on the Assad regime to actually consider some kind of meaningful resolution to what was inevitably going to be a very significant conflict. The details to that continue to be argued about to this day. The red line moment, as you described it, has long been described as an extremely significant turning point in the conflict. Up until that point, and you can draw these lines out very clearly, the Assad regime appeared to have been testing the red lines of the international community, from initially cracking down on protesters with tear gas, then automatic rifles, then tanks, then artillery, then helicopters, then fighter jets, then barrel bombs, and then finally chemical weapons. And at every single one of those points, he had no significant pushback from the international community, which I think is why myself included, a lot of analysts have said failing to push back on that red line essentially sent a message to the Assad regime in Damascus that it could literally get away with whatever it wanted to be able to do on the ground. And that fundamentally speaking, the international community wasn't willing enough to step in to make sure that flagrant abuses of human rights and war crimes had any kind of consequence. And so what we've seen since then is an increasingly strident and confident Assad regime, which despite coming under significant threat in 2011, 2015, was in a position to essentially request Russian support, which led to Russia's intervention late in 2015. And now we're in a situation where the Assad regime really has no interest to consider any kind of change in his country. He treated the Geneva III political process essentially as a joke. And that's a perfectly logical step for him. And it's very unfortunate that policymakers in the West haven't quite clocked on to the fact that there is essentially an everyday power assessment being made from Damascus and then to Washington and to Moscow and Tehran and London and Paris. And we, as the West, have failed resolutely up until now to show that there are any consequences for the kind of behavior that the Assad regime has been carrying out, and that we aren't necessarily dedicated to our maximum extent to try and find a resolution that will lead to some kind of stability in Syria in the future.
A quick follow-up. 3 years ago, the United States and Britain actually opted not to strike Assad's military, as we just said, after determining that he used chemical weapons. Some analysts are saying now, and Jay Solomon of the Wall Street Journal suggests, that President Obama may have been reluctant because in August 2013, he was negotiating this nuclear deal with Iran and perhaps feared that striking Iran's closest ally, Syria, might have scuttled the negotiations for the Iran nuclear deal. Now, Fred Hoff, a former White House advisor, disagrees, saying that that might not have been the consequences, that hitting Assad might not have at all scuttled this deal. How do you see it? Do you think that was part of the calculation of President Obama in resisting?
I find it hard to believe that it wasn't part of the calculation. I've been and sat in a number of meetings in the White House over the last few years on the subject of Syria. And for a period of time through 2014 and 2015, Iran always came up. If we do this, well, how will Iran react? And I received that response from senior White House officials on a number of occasions. So I find it hard to imagine that it wasn't a component of a calculation being made in the White House. Now, on the other hand, there were many other things going on within that broader calculus.
No question. We know President Obama's natural reluctance to use military force. And one quick corollary before I turn to my colleague Jeff, and that is the following. So do you think, knowing the players, that Iran would have pulled out of the nuclear deal negotiations had the United States, its allies, France, I'm referring to in particular, struck Bashar al-Assad's airstrips that were being used to send chemical weapons to kill his own people?
I think on balance, Iran would have actually probably remained within the talks. I think it had more to gain from making a deal. I think it would have made the negotiations a lot harder. I think Iran would have probably felt itself in a position to spoil the process, push for more concessions from the US, or at least push for a more advantageous deal with regards to Tehran's interests. But I think the potential benefits of actually making a deal for Iran would have been much more great than actually rescuing Assad. And fundamentally speaking, the kind of punitive military action that the United States and its allies were talking about in 2013 wasn't regime change. It was to send a message, and fairly limited targeted message, that you cannot get away with dropping chemical weapons on your own people within eyesight of your own presidential palace.
Let me turn to my colleague Jeff Selden.
One interesting question that arises from what we've been talking about is that there are some within the Obama administration, current officials, former officials, who have said that even without those strikes after drawing the red line, that the administration was still able to achieve what it wanted. It was able to negotiate a deal to take away the chemical weapons from Bashar al-Assad. Do you see what happened, given that they say that they achieved that objective, and to some extent it's been verified by the international community, that there's a deeper miscalculation, not necessarily of the situation or what goals it wants to achieve, but of the psyches of those involved, the mentalities of leaders like Bashar al-Assad or the Iranian regime that has been hurting U.S. policy?
I think, yes, absolutely. I think we've underestimated the extent to which Bashar al-Assad and his inner circle are willing to commit heinous crimes in order to stay in power, in order to send a message to the people that we will continue to kill you, in simple, straight words, until you submit to our authority. So I do think that has had a part to play. You know, at the same time, it is also worth mentioning that, yes, as you say, not pushing through in terms of the red line and carrying out military action in Syria did result in a chemical weapons agreement. Realistically speaking, in terms of my understanding of the deal, was it was actually a Russian agreement, not an American one. And there was an offer from Moscow that we've got a deal on the table, will you take it? And essentially, in simple terms, that's how it played out. But nonetheless, it's also worth mentioning that since that nuclear agreement, yes, the declared chemical weapons have been taken out of the country and destroyed. But there were also a great deal of undeclared chemicals. And a United Nations and OPCW investigation has just literally declared that industrial chlorine has been used by the regime on a number of occasions. And my own sources within Syrian community, and specifically within the military and their kind of research and development apparatus, these Syrians have said the Assad regime did not declare all of its chemical weapons. And their own estimates as Syrians range between 10 to 20% of their chemical weapons stockpile, which they allege still sit in Syria in secret bunkers somewhere in the country. Now, I can't verify whether that's true myself or not, but certainly those well-placed Syrians believe it to be true, having been involved in that kind of activity prior to their defection. So I think there are many, many more questions still to be asked about this whole issue.
In a sense, too, by failing to use even symbolic force, did the U.S. make it more difficult for itself by showing itself to be a paper tiger, willing to talk tough, but when it comes down to it, not willing to take the next step? And are threats from the U.S. now seen as less meaningful in the region, despite the fact that it's conducting the aerial campaign against Islamic State and to some degree has backed some of the Syrian forces that it's been working with, even against the Assad regime, but only of late, really?
Yeah, whether we like it or not, the fact that we didn't carry through with the red line means that our credibility in the Middle East and probably further afield is arguably at an all-time low. The Middle East has essentially, and especially the Arab Sunni Middle East, has essentially lost all faith in the United States as being an actor willing to transfer its words into action. And I think that has had knock-on effects with regards to the viability of a political settlement for Syria, with regards to trying to de-escalate the sectarian dynamic between Saudi Arabia and Iran, with regards to the conflict in Yemen, and a variety of other topics and crises within the region. And this is a consequence that we're going to have to deal with for a very long time. This is not something that can be quickly reversed. And arguably the fight against ISIS is also showing consequences of that with regards to certain regional states who ought to be playing more of a role, or arguably feel like they shouldn't be playing more of a role precisely because they don't trust the United States to follow through with some of its other commitments.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Charles Lister. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, that's a think tank here in Washington, and author of The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to one of our loyal fans, Ishak Ringham. He's from Jigawa State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Charles Lister, let's talk about recent developments, Turkey's entry into the fray, on the one hand to combat ISIS on the border, but at the same time, you know, they have their problems with the Syrian Kurds, who are, of course, backed by the United States as one of the strongest fighting forces against ISIS. So you have these conflicts. My question to you is, what is the relationship between Free Syria Army rebels and some of these U.S.-backed rebel groups, moderate groups, and the Syrian Kurdish militias, generally speaking?
The relationship as it currently stands can only be described as one of hostility. It's quite an unfortunate consequence, really. Prior to the crisis in Syria, prior to 2011, the dynamic between Sunni Arab populations in northern Syria and Kurdish populations in Syria was always a delicate one, although by and large they lived in peace. You know, the Kurdish population in northern Syria isn't a single community in terms of the political vision that they have. And one portion of that Kurdish political community has been empowered by the United States over the last couple of years to fight ISIL, and that is the YPG, as they're known, as a militia. And much as Western policymakers refuse to say it, they are the Syrian wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which is a terrorist organization, according to US law and a variety of other Western governments, which the Turkish government has been facing an insurgency from for decades. So by empowering the YPG in Syria as our favored actor to fight against the Islamic State, we have not only opened up, you know, fractures within northern Syrian society, as described in terms of the Sunni Arab opposition versus the YPG, but also opened up a fracture with regards to Turkish dynamics. And the Turkish government is furious, to say the least, and has been furious, watching essentially its decades-long enemy being empowered across the border by a fellow NATO ally. And Turkey's incursion into Syria is the consequence that basically we've been all waiting for, not necessarily because it's a good thing. In fact, it's not, but because it was an inevitability.
A question from Jeff.
With Turkey's intervention now in northern Syria, there have been a lot of questions, even from some U.S. officials, about how it's played out. And, of course, some Kurdish sources have raised a lot of questions about just how easy it seemed to be after intense fighting in other parts of northern Syria, specifically in Manbij, where the YPG was trying to take over and kick out Islamic State. It seemed that the Turkish-backed forces, Turkish tanks, FSA rebels, simply marched into Drablus easily, a ghost town like it had been completely deserted. And so now there are rumors that perhaps Turkey cut a side deal with the Islamic State. To what extent are so many of these factions playing off each other, playing against each other? And can the U.S. now trust any of them to really be moving forward with what the U.S. would like to see them do? In the case of Turkey, really take on Islamic State. In the case of its Kurdish allies, adhere to the geographical restrictions the U.S. says that they have agreed upon. And to what extent is all that going to get, in a sense, blown up by these smaller rivalries, political games, as each side seems to pursue its own agenda?
I think that's absolutely right. Every side is pursuing their own agenda. And Turkey's incursion wasn't solely to fight ISIL. It absolutely was to make sure that the Syrian Kurdish YPG was unable to essentially create a contiguous zone of territorial control across its entire southern border. So yes, the dynamics in northern Syria are intrinsically complex, and there are so many overlapping layers. With regards to Turkey's incursion and the ease with which they took Drablus, to be frank, I don't believe that they cut a deal with ISIS. I do think ISIS chose to basically withdraw. They were facing an enemy they were just never going to win against. Practically speaking, that morning when the offensive was launched, there were Turkish and American jets in the skies, American drones, Turkish special forces, Turkish tanks and artillery, as well as at least 1,500 Free Syrian Army rebels. There was no way that ISIS would have been able to hold their ground in Drablus against a force like that. And specifically, having already lost the town of Manbij, which was much more important than Drablus, there was no real strategic value in them actually trying to hold that ground. And more broadly, I think we are watching a point at which ISIS is weaker than it has been for several years. And it is no longer capable of choosing to defend every single village and town and city that it controls. And I think they made a strategic decision not to fight. But more broadly speaking, I do think Turkey's incursion, if directed in the right direction, and of course that's yet to be seen, will be capable of taking back territory from ISIS. And I think what's interesting and minimally talked about these days is that most of the groups involved who are fighting alongside the Turkish military themselves launched a massive offensive against the Islamic State in January 2014, when essentially the opposition was no longer willing to allow ISIS to be within its midst because it was steadily taking more and more of its territory from the opposition. And within 8 weeks of that offensive, these Free Syrian Army groups took, as a total, 4.5 provinces from the Islamic State in 8 weeks. I mean, that was an extraordinary advance. And this is a complaint that the opposition has long had, that we do, as the opposition, have a track record of fighting the Islamic State, but we've long been ignored by the West, and that history has been forgotten. What I'm saying, I guess, is there is a potential that potential can be brought out against the Islamic State, but a lot of that depends on whether or not we can divert the Turks and the opposition away from fighting the Kurds. And there is a great deal of diplomatic and military activity going on to try and make sure that that's the case.
To what extent is the existence, the evolution of ISIS-Daesh actually a product of the brutal Assad regime? I know there are many other antecedents. So the fundamental question is, can the fight against ISIS even succeed without addressing the Iranian and Russian-backed brutal Assad regime, whom many analysts say fuels Sunni extremism in the region.
A quick bit of history as a side note. The Assad regime has a very clear precedent for secretly, through his intelligence services, supporting jihadist militancy in fighting against the United States and its allies in Iraq from 2003 to 2010. And that's been extensively detailed. And the United States was certainly well aware of the fact that probably 90% of foreign fighters who went into Iraq during those 7 or 8 years traveled through Syrian airports and in many cases were bussed by the Syrian government to the Iraqi border. So there's a lot of history here. So undoubtedly, the Assad regime has had a part to play in growing ISIS's predecessor movements in Iraq. Now, ISIS itself was actually recovering in Iraq separate from Syrian instability and prior to the Syrian revolution starting. So to some extent, a direct correlation can't be drawn between the Assad regime's behavior in Syria and the growth of or recovery of ISIS. But definitely ISIS was able to exploit the fact that the Assad regime had created a massive amount of instability within Syrian territory in order to expand from Iraq into Syria. So that has definitely benefited it. But more broadly, extremists on all sides of the Syrian conflict have benefited from the fact that the Assad regime has refused to negotiate, has refused to reform in its earliest months of the revolution, and has continued to be so brutal against his population. Within my area of work, actually, Al-Qaeda has benefited the most from that, a lot more than the Islamic State, and it will continue to benefit the most from that. So the newly rebranded Jabhat Fateh al-Sham has the most potential to continue to benefit from the Assad regime's political intransigence and military brutality, because their entire narrative is founded on the basis that the Assad regime will never give up power and it will continue to kill you as Syrians for as long as Bashar al-Assad continues to be alive in Syria. And as part of that narrative, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham says the international community will do nothing to help you. So therefore, we are your only allies. And that is a narrative that has succeeded more and more every single day for the last 5 years. That's not a narrative that ISIS has been able to tap into. In fact, they haven't really tried to tap into it. But Al-Qaeda has undoubtedly benefited. And that is a subject and a topic of that should be of serious concern in the West these days.
Because Al-Qaeda does have sights on foreign countries, more so than ISIS.
Ultimately speaking, yes. I think the Syrian conflict has provided Al-Qaeda with an opportunity to adapt its modus operandi. And so now we're actually seeing Al-Qaeda adopting much more of a long game strategy, what I call controlled pragmatism. In a sense, we're seeing a totally new Al-Qaeda emerge, which isn't in the immediate term dedicated to imposing the most extreme value system that we've previously seen Al-Qaeda do. Al-Qaeda in Syria has never chopped off a hand, has never publicly beheaded civilians for certain crimes. They have withheld themselves from doing that in order to build popular support. So the long game strategy is that sometime in the future, the communities within which they operate will have been socialized into supporting Al-Qaeda operating within their midst to such an extent that they will then be able to impose those kinds of value systems and establish an Islamic emirate in Syria. And that is something that we've been methodically watching develop since 2012. And we are at the stage, having this organization just rebranded, that is a specific phase in this long game strategy to continue to embed within the local population. And so that's why I would say, actually, you know, this organization, much as the opposition sees it as an invaluable military ally, it could well become its biggest threat, its biggest internal danger in the years to come, precisely because its values don't align with that of the Syrian revolution and with the kind of values that the opposition founded the protest movement in 2011.
Well, speaking of the protest movement, which was peaceful in the beginning, 2011, another historical if question, and that is, you know, had the United States, the Friends of Syria, been more supportive of the civilians, whether politically or sending of appropriate weaponry, could they have resisted the depredations of the Assad regime? Could they have forestalled the entry of Russia, which came in big time last year?
I think it's almost an impossible question to prove, but certainly there is an argument to be made that if there's one thing that can be learnt from the Assad regime over the last 5 years. It's that it is intensely sensitive to pressure. The difficulty or the unfortunate point to make here is that it hasn't felt pressure on very many occasions. And arguably, the one point at which it felt the most pressure was following the chemical weapons attack in Damascus in 2013. And for a few days before the UK Parliament voted against military action and before the Obama administration agreed to the deal offered to it by Moscow, the threat of what in reality was very limited punitive targeted measures by the United States in Syria had a catastrophic impact in Damascus. And I think this has long been ignored because it's an inconvenient fact for those who oppose any level of military action in Syria. But according, again, to my sources in Syria who were in Damascus at the time, not in the opposition, but living in government-held areas, half of the Syrian parliament packed up their homes and fled to Beirut because of the threat of very limited Western military action in Syria. And it would have been at a point like that where, yes, we should have probably followed through with the red line and carried out some minimal military actions, but it would have then been the point at which to push a political process, a negotiation process, because of that pressure felt within the regime and the fact that it felt so delicate and sensitive. We missed that opportunity. I think that was arguably the biggest opportunity we've had.
And as a consequence, would you say that the opposition, the defectors from the army, known as the Free Syria Army, and the civilian coordinating committees, would they have felt bolstered and not have gone into the hands of the more jihadi elements, which we see happening, which we saw happening?
For the opposition, the failure to push through the red line was the biggest turning point of the conflict for them in terms of the broader narrative. They strongly believed that at that point, when the United States and its allies failed to follow through, they had lost their biggest and most potentially important ally, which was the Western world or the international community, as they call it. And that sent a message to them, for the first time really, that the world wasn't substantially enough behind their cause. Yes, there can definitely be argued that to a certain extent, the most moderate elements of the opposition lost their confidence at that point. The Free Syrian Army was still at this point trying to represent a single organization. And I think very, very quickly that just dissolved. Any attempt to help to establish a single Free Syrian Army movement stopped immediately at that point, precisely because of the loss of confidence. And as a consequence of that, we saw the more Islamist portions of the opposition almost overnight gain credibility on the ground, because they had always been making the argument that the world wasn't going to come to their rescue. Unfortunately, we emboldened the narrative of extremists on the ground. And as I say, since 2011, those narratives have only got stronger because of the perception of our own inaction.
The West created, to some extent, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, absolutely.
And as we close, Charles Lister, can anything come of talks between the United States and Russia, this talk about coordinating military strikes against ISIS? Again, one might say, well, ISIS is just one side of the coin, and we've been talking about this for so long, and nothing seems to come of this purported cooperation when we have such divergent objectives in Syria backing different sides.
Yeah, I think there are certainly divergent objectives, although I would probably argue they're perhaps not necessarily as divergent as the popular narrative might suggest. I don't think the Kremlin is sold on Bashar al-Assad as an individual. I think they would be willing to give concessions and to come up with a compromise in terms of a future leader of Syria. But right now, today, more than objectives or different to objectives, I would say just we have divergent behaviours. Unfortunately, the Russian government has been playing a spoiling role, in fact, with regards to some of the United States' counterterrorism actions. But at the same time, it has to be admitted, you know, Russia intervened in Syria in 2015, and it is a powerful country that we have to accept now plays a significant role in determining Syria's future. And I think the Obama administration has accepted that fact, although I think they're seeking too much than what is actually realistic. Some extent of military cooperation in terms of fighting against ISIS, I don't necessarily see as a bad thing. In terms of their targeting strategy against al-Qaeda, I don't think the conditions have been set for considering something like that as a constructive move. And finally, on the political process, I don't see anything moving until the Assad regime feels that it's under more pressure than it is right now. So the biggest positive really we can get is trying to calm the situation down in Syria and getting a more effective cessation of hostilities, which, as far as I understand it, is now the core area of discussion within US-Russian negotiations.
Charles Lister is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, a think tank here in Washington, and author of The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. We'll have to continue this conversation another day, Charles, but thank you very much for your terrific insights.
Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. And joining me on the program was VOA national correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.